This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. 11 afternoon, the snow has stopped downtown Chicago. Some of you had sunshine through the morning. We were in a snow squall closer to the lake. That's the way it is in Chicago. The Wintrust Business Lunch is produced by Pete Zimmerman. We're here until 1 o'clock, then the Anna DeVlanta Show. We start this afternoon with Brian Battle, the Director of Trading at Performance Trust Capital Partners. You can visit these folks at performancetrust.com. Brian, welcome to the show. We're glad you could join us.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
Overall, jobless claims worse than expected. Is there a bright side to this, or kind of put it in perspective for us?
Yeah, I think jobless claims is a number that is pretty well followed because it's a number of how many people are filing for unemployment. So at 790,000 or so, that number seems really high. Compared to March, we had 7 million people filing for unemployment. But if you go back to before the quarantine, the public response, the public policy response, remember, to the coronavirus isn't what's killing the economy. It's the lockdown that's killing the economy. So before coronavirus, we had unemployment claims in like the 200, 250,000 range. So the number is still high, but the trend is coming down slowly. So it's a number to be constructive about, but it's coming down slowly because the economy and the U.S., the states are opening slowly.
Why do you make that point? It's the lockdown. The lockdown came because of the virus. I mean, it was a logical thing to do, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm not challenging the logic of quarantine, but it's just not, I don't want people to think like, oh, there's no mystery about why the U.S. economy slowed down and collapsed. It's because we closed the economy down. We shut down supply and demand.
Right.
So we sent everybody home. So that, you know, we're still arguing about what caused the depression in the 20s. We know exactly what's killing the U.S. economy right now. And so that's starting to unwind. So it won't be mysterious to get the U.S. economy to recover again. Is you vaccine people, you get herd immunity, everybody goes back to work, and the U.S. economy should recover.
I hope you're right. I mean, I do see the logic in that. That door should swing equally well both ways, right? I mean,
right.
Do you expect it's going to be that simple? Or maybe something has changed since March and the economy isn't going to be the same.
Well, there's a couple of things have changed, and you're right. I mean, we slammed the economy shut. It's way easier to turn the economy off than to turn it on. You know, you can just think of the supply chain of, yeah, you close a car factory, you can turn it off today, but to start it back up again tomorrow is there's a giant lag in the supply chain. You need computer chips and aluminum and rubber tires and wires. You know, all this stuff takes a while to wind up again. But I am constructive on the U.S. economy, and so fundamentally, you know, we're going to get back to consuming and borrowing and going to work. But there's three things that are also stacked in favor of the U.S. economy. The first is monetary policy. So the Federal Reserve has said they're going to hold interest rates down and they're going to be very patient. So Jay Powell, who's a Federal Reserve chairman, just yesterday said we're a long way from full recovery. So that's not bad news that we're a long way. I don't think anybody expects that we're that close. It's going to take a while. But that means the Federal Reserve is going to hold rates down. So Jerome Powell is a Fed member, but he's a lawyer. So his exact term was they are patiently accommodative. So they're going to wait and see. So they're promising low interest rates. And that's fundamentally good for stocks because it's easier for companies to borrow. It's inexpensive and it allows them to succeed in their businesses.
Yeah, there we go again. Stocks good, but wages and jobs bad. I mean, I think you know how you have a quarterback rating and you can tell how a quarterback did by this rating, which isn't based on 1 to 100. You could have a quarterback rating of 112. I say all of that to say this. I wish we had a number. What would be the best measure of how we are overall doing? And it would take into account equities, but also wages and employment. You know, I mean, where are we really, Brian?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we have 330 million people pursuing their own self-interest in about a $20 trillion economy. So it's hard to boil it down to one number. You know, it's just you just can't get it to like one thing. But the stock market is not the economy, right? So let's be careful about that too.
Yep, yep.
So monetary policy is accommodative. The Federal Reserve is doing what they can to keep rates low, and anybody that's refinanced their mortgage has benefited from that. The quarantine seems to be ending. I read today that hospitalization rates are the lowest they've been in 3 months, so that's good. So the trend is coming back, and Jerome Powell is reasonable to be patient. You know, it's going to take a little while. The thing that's really most probably powerful and the thing that is helping the U.S. economy and the stock market particularly is fiscal policy, the actions of the U.S. Congress. And all you can say to that is, wow, they are going full bore. The Federal Reserve used to complain that Congress wasn't doing their job, that low rates can't fix everything. So just to put it in context, there's a lot of big numbers flying around. But if the U.S. GDP, so the gross domestic product of the United States, is about $20 trillion, Congress is talking about adding another $2 trillion in stimulus funding. So another way to think of that is Congress is going to increase the size of the U.S. economy by 10% with a stroke of a pen. So that is very stimulative, you know, that gets into the economy. How much it'll help long term, I'm not sure. But in the short term, having cash into the economy is helpful. And some of that money comes in through just direct payments to taxpayers. Some of that comes through direct federal aid to the states. Congress is talking about sending $350 billion to the states, which is 20% of all state tax revenue. So these numbers are gigantic. And you might ponder, like, wow, with 790,000 people on filing unemployment claims, how can everything feel so good? Is because there's been so much stimulus coming from Washington, D.C.
A conversation we'll have another day then is who and when is somebody going to pay for that? But I hear what you're saying. Brian Battle is the director of trading at Performance Trust Capital Partners, performancetrust.com. Brian, really interesting. You got to join us again. Thanks for your time today.
My pleasure, John. Lots to talk about.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, Shara Tipkin joins us now, senior reporter at CNET. Visit CNET.com. Hi, Shara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I read on your site that the news feed I get on Facebook might be doctored or changed now. What's going on here?
Yeah. So Facebook is going to start doing a test to remove some political information. I think that over the past year, certainly we've all been seeing a lot of politically charged news, comments from others, and Facebook now is just looking at reducing that. It's doing the test first in Canada and Brazil, also Indonesia, and then it'll start testing it in the U.S. So not everyone's going to see a change, but some of us could.
What are they going to change? I mean, I may want political information. In fact, people do. Are we just talking about hoax news, false news, or what are they going to do?
Yeah, they've done a huge effort to try to reduce things that are spreading misinformation, inaccurate information, things that are, the election was the vaccine was a hoax, the election was stolen, things like this that are not true. For some of us too, there's too much political information. So that's why they're doing this test. They're going to survey people afterwards to say, hey, did this improve your experience on social media or did it make it worse? You know, a lot of people are on Facebook because they want to see pictures of their nieces and nephews or their grandkids, and they want to know what's going on with people they worked with previously or graduated with. They don't necessarily want to see just politics all the time. Yeah. So I think Facebook's really trying to find a way to kind of balance political content with what Facebook kind of started as, which is a way to connect you with your network.
Boy, they sure lost their way. I mean, if they can tweak the algorithm and make it less sensational, right? Oh, you clicked on that story. You must be interested in election stories. Here's what's hot with election stories. And then you get false information. And Facebook was part and parcel of that, right? I mean, they didn't seem to be super interested in fixing that 4 years ago or a year ago. But better late than never, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, and we're all guilty of this, like, if you read something that's kind of sensational, you want to read more and you engage more and, you maybe will get sucked into Facebook. Like, social media addiction is a thing. People, I doom scroll on Twitter for, hours some evenings. We all do that. And, Facebook was kind of giving us what we wanted, but also giving us more than what we really needed and more than what we wanted.
Yeah,
and it's kind of having to deal with this. Yeah, it's having to deal with this reckoning of, it did affect an election. It does affect how people feel about things and what people think and what information people get. And it has to have some responsibility for that instead of saying, hey, I'm just the pipe that's pushing this out there. Like, it's not my fault.
What if the president, Trump, runs for president again? Will Twitter let him back on since he's a candidate again?
Twitter said no, that once you're banned, you're banned. We haven't seen bannings of huge public figures like this. This hasn't happened all the time. You know, this is kind of a new case where the president of the United States gets banned from something. So I think Twitter is kind of trying to learn as it's going along. And what it's saying is, no, he broke rules. He incited violence. We are not letting him back on our platform. You know, as the president of the United States, if he's running again, a major political candidate, there are plenty of ways for him to get his message out. He doesn't have to rely on Twitter. It's not like this is his only connection with people, with media, with the world. Arguments that this limits his ability to have free speech, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. some of these things doesn't quite hold here.
Twitter's a lot quieter these days, though, isn't it? I mean,
it is, yes.
Do you know what I mean, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. I'm based on the West Coast, and I'd wake up every morning wondering what was tweeted while I was asleep. What did I miss? Like, what's been happening? And now you wake up and you're like, oh, okay. Like, it's calmer.
But also there's less urgency to it. So I don't know if Twitter cares. Maybe they do. But I'll bet I go to Twitter a lot less now. I'm following it a lot less closely. And that can't be good for Twitter, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is a fact that a lot of people followed Donald Trump. A lot of people checked Twitter obsessively because of him. He kind of became associated with Twitter. He used it frequently to announce policy changes or to target people or to just share his opinion. And we were paying a lot of attention to it. For Twitter, I think it's good that they are taking this stand, even if it is something that ultimately will hurt their financials, hurt their user engagement. It would be easy just to let Trump back on and let him tweet whatever he wants and, you know, all the eyeballs and all the engagement with that. But they've really taken this stand of, no, he incited violence. He crossed the line. And because he crossed that line, we can't let him back on our website.
It's all the time we have to read more about this and other stories, including one that begins, I'm here live. I'm not a cat. And everybody loves that story. Go to CNET.com. It's a great little break from the craziness. Shara Tipkin is a senior reporter at CNET. Shara, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Alexander the other day talked about taking not a taxi, but an air taxi to the airport. More details on that from Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a couple of minutes. Right now, let's talk about more traditional means of getting about, that is gas in your car. Our guest is from GasBuddy.com, and that's Patrick DeHaan, the head of petroleum analysis there. Patrick, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
You guys do an annual survey. I saw the study. Some of the numbers are a little surprising to me. Let's start with what jumps out at you the most. How has our gas purchasing changed in the last 12 months?
Well, you know, it's obvious in this study that there's a lot of households out there that are hurting. It's evidenced by the fact that people are trying to save wherever they can. Of course, you know, when you're out on the road, I think shopping around for gasoline is probably one of the easiest ways to shave down on what, for many people, is a $1,000 plus bill per year for filling your tank up. I think what was perhaps most surprising, though, of that is that 83% of the people that we studied, some 2,500 people, had said that they had been in a situation where they fill up and just down the road a few miles or on their way home, they see prices moments later that are quite a bit less. So still a lot of Americans that are just going to a station and kind of filling up blindly.
Do we pay almost $1,000 a year on average on gas?
Oh, I think the average household is actually closer to $1,500 or $1,600. So an individual, you know, if you're shelling out driving, say, 12 to 15,000 miles a year, which would be considered average, you're consuming close to 600 gallons of gasoline a year. And, of course, in an area like Chicago, where gas prices, at least right now, closer to $3, that could even rival $1,500 or $1,800 a car. So certainly our higher prices mean that you're shelling out even more to fill your tank up over the course of the year.
So how much are people losing then because they're not going to the better price stations?
Well, just that bad behavior, that is the pulling in apathetically, not shopping around in an area like Chicago can cost you $150 to $200 a year, especially because our prices tend to be so volatile between the cities and suburbs. You may work in one and live in the other, and of course the suburbs tends to be lower, but today finds prices downtown $1 a gallon more. So for those commuters, if you're not filling up on the perfect spot, you're probably spending 15 or maybe even 25 cents a gallon more than you should.
There's a gas station downtown, not too far from the Ohio feeder off the Kennedy, and I think anybody there is like, oh, crap. Liz, this is the loser parade. And you know it, but it, sometimes you just haven't managed your gas efficiently, and you know there's that spot, so you take it and you take your lumps. I have it in my mind that if you are getting gas in parts of Chicago, in Cook County, in Illinois, and if you do it at the wrong month of the year, you are actually buying some of the most expensive gasoline in the contiguous 48. Is that probably true?
It's pretty spot on. You know, let's exclude California from that contiguous 48 simply because California has so many more taxes and a carbon management program as well. But, you know, you sum it up perfectly. I know when I have business around the city, if I have to go to the suburb, I absolutely never fill up in the city unless, like you said. Now, it's rare that a guy like me, you know, manages the tank poorly, but sometimes you get in that predicament where life gets ahead of you, and that's the last thing you want to do, right, is fill up in Chicago. Or our gas taxes in Chicago also just went up another few cents a gallon. But you look at the suburbs today, Calumet City, $2.34 a gallon, Bolingbrook, $2.43, and then you compare it to, you know, my corner station here in the city, which is $2.80, and downtown $3.30 a gallon.
Should there be some uniformity to that? Or maybe, I guess it's an open market, it's commercial business, but I wonder why they are so drastically different.
Well, you know, a lot of it probably has to do with competition. The cost of doing business in the central business loop is probably much higher. You know, you talk about property taxes and all the bills that stations have to pay, but you know, being in the central business district, there's additional taxes, too, that have to be considered when selling gasoline. So all of those lumped together create a very high price environment downtown.
Sometimes, though, you'll see two different prices drastically so across the corner from each other. You know, it's not city and county. It's Sunoco on the one side and Shell on the other, or whoever's selling gas these days.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk to me briefly about the mistake people make swiping their card when they pay for gas. What are you guys saying about that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways to pay for gasoline now, whether it's a credit card, rebates on credit cards, debit cards, of course, cash. I mean, there's other things. Some gas stations you can now even pay with crypto. But that's the inherent danger, is that if you're not paying that credit card off every month in full, you end up paying 20% interest or so, maybe it's less, probably more, and that completely negates the 2% rewards you get back for it. So, you know, debit card in a hard economy may be the way to go, because instead of, you know, paying the retail price, you know, there are debit cards out there. We have one that you can save a few cents on your debit card. So, but either way you look at it, there's so many different ways, loyalty, credit card rewards, as long as you're paying your bill off, there's a lot of way to avoid paying that retail price.
There is a credit card I should get for buying gas?
Well, I mean, there's a few. Everyone's purposes are different, but, you know, there are credit cards. Like I said, if you pay your bill off, it can make it worth it. But GasBuddy has our own debit card. It links with a checking account that we offer savings up to 25 cents a gallon if you get what's called a dealer. Some stations opt in with us to give you some savings. But at least that way, the money's coming right out of your bank account. And you don't pay interest on it.
Anything else we should notice about the survey you all have done?
Well, you know, I think that we've pretty well covered it. I mean, it can't be overstated, though, that motors should always be shopping around, whether that's using Google Maps or Waze or the GasBuddy website. There's so many ways out there, and it only seems like a few cents a gallon, but the whole thing is when you're pumping 600 gallons a year, it all does add up.
I'm glad you did the math on that. And one last thing, though, is what's the price that people are paying on average right now? I guess, hear it again, depends on where you are, but do you have a number for us for Illinois or
I
the Chicago?
I do, yeah, you know,
area?
It's Chicago lands at 273. It's up 20 cents in the last month, And now we're paying right at the same level, 273, same price as a year ago. So we've come a long way from those prices that were almost a dollar a gallon last March and April.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you see it moving one direction or another anytime soon?
I think there is more risk of upside as we continue to see the country recover from the pandemic or improve as vaccination spread. There's more of a risk of rising gasoline demand this summer. And since OPEC has cut production in light of the pandemic, that could put prices even higher this spring and summer.
OPEC notwithstanding, though, in general, higher gas prices are a sign that the economy is doing well, right? If it's under $2 a gallon, that's great, but that also says something bad, doesn't it?
Well, as long as the economy is doing good, we tend to see more demand and thus higher prices. But a lot of that, of course, is contingent on OPEC balancing the market. And right now there's the argument that perhaps they're not producing as much as they should. And we'll potentially see an adjustment from them in the future.
Patrick DeHaan is the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com. Interesting, Patrick. Thanks for your time today. Appreciate the results on the study.
My pleasure.
It's 12:43. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United's first 737 MAX flight since the worldwide grounding departed from the airline's Denver hub earlier today, bound for Houston. United has roughly 550 flights scheduled for the MAX this month and about 2,000 for March. United says it expects to take delivery of 24 MAX planes this year. It had 14 in its fleet at the time of the 2019 grounding that followed two fatal crashes in 6 months. Mr. Peanut has a new home. Kraft made it official today, announcing the sale of the Planters brand to Hormel in a deal valued at more than $3 billion. Already home to Spam and Skippy, Hormel will add mixed nuts, corn nuts, cheese balls, cheese curls, and trail mix to its portfolio. The deal is expected to be completed by the end of the year. Kraft Heinz shares today rose as it beat estimates on the top and bottom lines for its latest quarter. McDonald's has heard the complaints and is bringing back the fan favorite Hi-C orange drink after a nearly four-year absence from its soda fountains. The beverage will begin reappearing in select restaurants this month and will be available nationwide by June. McDonald's says the return was prompted by boisterous fans on social media who passionately asked to bring it back over the years. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth comes your way right now. Let's talk about flying taxis to the airport, Amy.
I had a feeling you wanted to start with that story today. Yeah, so United is investing $20 million in an electric aircraft startup business called Archer. And they've also had they've placed an option to eventually acquire 200 to 500 of these taxis. They're little tiny helicopters. They look very, very futuristic. That would essentially, they can travel about 60 miles. They take off and just like a helicopter, you know, vertically and land vertically, with the aim of getting people to the airport quickly. So they're trying to pilot this in some big cities where it's kind of congested to get to the airport. So United has kind of put this big stake in there, saying we want this to be a feature. We, you know, our plan is if this works, we want to be able to offer this to our customers. So in theory, you could say, you know, catch a little tiny helicopter, and they're small. They're only a few seats. Take this little helicopter taxi from, say, you know, Millennium Park and then be at O'Hare for your United flight. So that'll be something to watch for sure. There's lots of airspace news right now, but I thought that was kind of an interesting one. These tiny little helicopters, they're very cute. They look, they're just like a teeny tiny little helicopter.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm intrigued by that. And I guess the question is, how much would you pay and where do you get it? If it's easy to access, like Millennium Park or maybe a mall parking space where they've rented some area, then I'm kind of intrigued.
Yeah, me too. And I think that's kind of what the test case is going to be. There's going to be some research done to say, like, how much would people pay for that? Would that breed loyalty to United mm-hmm. if they had this, you know, little helicopter taxi service? And what kind of timeline? But essentially, Archer said they plan to start production in 2023 and start offering consumer flights in 2024. So not that far off. We think of, you know, taking a helicopter to the airport is something very wealthy people or way in the future or both can do. But this is Archer and United are trying to make that happen much sooner.
Aldi's opening a bunch of new stores. Are they going to open them around here?
Yeah, so Aldi, based in Batavia, so that's, of course, why we're watching that story closely. They're going to open another 100 stores nationwide and add curbside pickup at 500 stores. So by the end of this year, they're going to have curbside pickup at about 1,200 stores. What I thought was really interesting about this was not only, you know, Aldi's expansion and how much just they've changed and grabbed so much of the market share in recent years, but the way they're kind of positioning this, they're really counting on people getting having gotten used to online shopping for groceries and staying that way. You know, the data they were citing is really kind of about a lot of people got used to shopping online for groceries this year, and we anticipate that will stay even post pandemic. So they're adding, adding these functions, adding more stores, and allowing people to just pull up and have their groceries put right in their car.
I like the sound of that, although I would see a higher-end grocery store kind of being on the cutting edge of that. I don't see Aldi in that space, but I guess everybody in every bracket likes to save if they can, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, looking at consumer behavior and how people are shopping, what the average ticket price is, the spend is for things like Instacart and things like that for grocery delivery, I think data suggests we saw delivery happening on a lot of different from a lot of different stores and also a lot of different, you know, final receipt prices. So they're going to expand this and allow people to, you know, fewer people to be in the store, things like that. We'll see what that translates to. You know, of course, there are costs with that. There's, costs for workers to get them trained and put that in the car rather than be at a register, things like that. But, you know, they were talking about data from Brick and Click, which is an analytics firm. And just kind of looking at the numbers there, online grocery sales hit $8.1 billion with a B in November. That was up from $2 billion in August of 2019. So pre-pandemic, we're looking at $2 billion. Over $8 billion in November, quite a difference. And I think grocers are just sort of looking at a way to hang on to that wave.
Speaking of billions were stolen from unemployment coffers. We know about that in Illinois. What are you seeing about that?
Yeah, so some people are getting forms. It's a mysterious 1099-G IRS form for unemployment benefits they never got. They didn't apply for them, didn't receive them, anything like that. It is kind of the impact of if there was identity theft, if somebody applied for unemployment benefits under your name or social security number and received them, you will probably get this tax form. So there's a lot of people that are very stressed out about this. Obviously, if you're getting taxed about this as we enter tax season, what do you do about that? There's a couple things you can do. First of all is notify the IRS that you got it and that you did not those were not benefits that you received. And the IRS has also more recently told people don't include that 1099-G form. If it's an error, don't put it in with your taxes. I think that was a big question of some people going, well, do I send it in anyway, even though I didn't get this? Don't send it in if it's not accurate, but do let the IRS know. And also check your earning records with Social Security. You can go to ssa.gov/myaccount and you can kind of take a look. And if there are items that need to be corrected, then you can contact your local office and they will help you through that process if you get that form.
We've been talking about Bitcoin here and there the last week or so.
Yeah.
MasterCard and Bitcoin, what's happening there?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So MasterCard is sort of they've created a path to allow their customers to use Bitcoin. Essentially, the way it would work is that if you want to buy an item with Bitcoin, MasterCard then has cryptocurrency partners that will convert that into traditional cash and then transmit that over MasterCard's network. So it's a way to kind of pay with your MasterCard by using Bitcoin, much in the way that you can pay with a credit card using PayPal. It kind of becomes your cash register that does the transaction. MasterCard would essentially be that transaction midpoint, that kind of that go between middleman to do that transaction. But I think it's been an interesting moment for cryptocurrency. You know, we saw earlier this week Elon Musk talking about, you know, allowing people to buy a Tesla with cryptocurrency. And just looking even 6 months or a year ago, still so many people in the finance world really looked at it very skeptically. So to see big names like Tesla and MasterCard really getting behind it in a meaningful way, I think will legitimize it and get more people using it creatively.
Okay, something else we got to learn about. And
I know.
I'm still trying to figure out TikTok. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. You and me both. Thanks.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.